Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Susan Raske, senior lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and I'll be your moderator for today's event. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Jonathan Alter. As a senior editor at Newsweek since 1991, Jonathan Alter has written a widely acclaimed column that examines politics, media, and social and global issues. Mr. Alter is also an originator and author of the weekly Conventional Wisdom Watch, which uses up and down and sideways arrows to measure and lampoon the news. He's also been a freelance writer for such publications as The New Republic, Esquire, and The New York Times. Since 1996, Mr. Alter has been a contributing correspondent for NBC News, where he appears regularly on all NBC broadcasts, including Today, NBC Nightly News, NBC News Specials, MSNBC, and CNBC. Mr. Alter has earned many awards for his political columns, including a prize from the National Headliner Awards for a series on life after 9/11. He also received the John Bartlow Martin Award in 2001 for his reporting on the death penalty. In 1995, Mr. Alter was selected as one of the nation's most influential media critics by the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center at Columbia University. He's a Chicago native and received his BA in history with honors from Harvard in 1979. Mr. Alter is here today as the author of his new book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. The book explores how President Franklin Delano Roosevelt showed political... The book explores how President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's shrewd political nature effectively shaped policy and opinion during one of the most tumultuous periods of American history. Mr. Alter brings both a historical and a journalistic perspective on how the current administration could learn from FDR's leadership. So please, welcome Jonathan Alter.
Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club. Thanks to everybody for coming today and those who are listening on the radio. Thanks to you. Franklin Roosevelt was asked, what advice did he have for people who were giving talks? And he said, three pieces of advice: be sincere, be brief, and be seated. I'm not sure I'm going to entirely take his advice, but I wanted to start out today by telling a little story about how in taking his own advice, he saved his life, and I would argue the life of the nation, at a critical moment. In February of 1933, the country was at the bottom of the Great Depression, except nobody knew that at the time. Unemployment in some places was 80%. The banks were cratering all over the country. The financial system was melting down. People genuinely wondered, prominent people, whether capitalism was at an end and whether democracy was at an end. There was a strong appetite for dictatorship, which in those days, at that period, for another year or so, had a positive connotation. It's hard for us to imagine now, but there were editorials in many newspapers, with the headline, Wanted, a Dictator. And Walter Lippmann, who was later a Newsweek columnist and the most prominent pundit of the day, and at a time when columnists, unlike today, as Susan knows, actually had stature in society. And he went to Roosevelt a couple of weeks before his inauguration and said, Franklin, you may have to take dictatorial powers. That's how bad things were. and many other such examples. So he's scheduled to be sworn in as president on March 4th, 1933. That, in those days, the inauguration was in March. And in February, as the financial system of the United States is cratering, he decides to go on a yachting trip. He goes with Vincent Astor on his yacht, one of the rich men of the day. His parents had gone down on the Titanic. And he goes with some of his boon companions, as he called them. Eleanor says, why do you want to go off on a yachting trip with a bunch of rich, boring guys? And he says, well, he just decides he's going to do it, because he did pretty much what he wanted to. He was selecting the cabinet by radiogram in code from this yacht in the Caribbean. 10 days, the president-elect leaves to go off with his friends, and he plays practical jokes on his companions. He liked doing this kind of thing. Later, he would actually make, as president, he would actually make phony phone calls as part of his practical jokes on reporters. This time on the yacht, he put together a little sort of mimeograph newspaper with headlines from what was going on shore, and he would read them to the other guests on the yacht. And one of them, he said, the United States Supreme Court has declared that all divorced spouses must return to their mates if their divorces are not complete, pending further review by the courts. And so he sees this guy who's one of his friends who has just gone through a divorce, and he's blanching, and Roosevelt said, I'm kidding, it's a joke. So the yacht lands in Miami, and he motorcade to Bayfront Park in Miami. This is 2.5 weeks before he becomes president. And waiting for him in the crowd is an Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara. And Roosevelt is propped up on the back of a convertible, and he gives a very short speech. He talks about how he gained 10 pounds on this trip. He's going to take it off. He caught some nice fish. He's looking forward to being sworn in as president. Nothing substantive. Speech lasts about 2 minutes. And he takes his own advice. He's sincere. He's brief. And he's seated. And he is helped back down into the seat of the car, making himself a smaller target. And Zangara gets off 5 shots from 25 feet away and ends up killing the mayor of Chicago. And Roosevelt cradles the dying mayor in his arms all the way to the hospital, and then proceeds with the transition. Showed great courage that night. He backs up the car, even though they're not sure if there's another gunman, to pick up the mayor who's lying on the ground. And then he tells the whole story to the press the next day in a very thrilling narrative fashion, because he was a good storyteller, on the train on the way back to New York. And at this time, Roosevelt was actually quite unpopular. He had been overwhelmingly elected president the previous November over Herbert Hoover, although he had only barely been nominated for president on the fourth ballot in Chicago at the Democratic Convention, in part because many Democrats didn't like him. They thought he was unprincipled and a flip-flopper. Sound familiar? He was for the League of Nations before he was against the League of Nations. He wasn't a wet on prohibition. He wasn't a dry on prohibition. He was a damp. So any Democrats who say, you know, who have this kind of very marbleized vision of Franklin Roosevelt and are wondering, you know, can we ever find another leader who can help us, should realize that greatness comes in unusual packages sometimes, which is one of the points of my book. Zangara gets off these shots. Roosevelt survives, and he's unpopular because he hasn't joined with Hoover in trying to stop this crisis. He believes he doesn't have authority yet, so why should he be joining with Hoover. And he actually, his theatrical sense tells him, yeah, let the economy sink lower into further crisis so that I can enter as the big hero, which is what he did. The American public at that time, they were not very approving of this strategy. And yet after he's shot, in the same way, almost shot, he wasn't hit, miraculously, in the same way that Ronald Reagan, after he was shot shortly after coming to the presidency, it helped his Reagan revolution get through Congress, his budget and tax plans. I argue that this assassination attempt really helped Roosevelt pull off this major transformation in American life in the first 100 days he was in office. Every other book, it's a footnote or maybe two lines. For me, it's a chapter in the same way that I devote a chapter to that famous first fireside chat, chapter to the famous first inaugural, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," which was actually nonsense. People had a lot more to fear than fear itself. They were fearing, how are you going to put the food on the table? They actually had lost everything if they put their money in one of the 10,000 banks that went out of business. And what Roosevelt was able to do was create what in drama is called the willing suspension of disbelief. It was a theatrical act, which was followed up by great action. But he was able to combine vision, which we'll get to in a bit, communication, and action. And in a few short weeks, save both capitalism and democracy. So I got interested in writing this book because I was interested in leadership. What is leadership? How does somebody combine at a very high level brilliant vision, brilliant communication, brilliant action? And I think it applies to anybody running a business, running a PTA, you know, any kind of leadership position to try to get at what the components are of leadership. And that's what interested me. How did he pull off this conjuring act? Just what it was, because the same people who had their money, their remaining money under the mattress, and were pushing each other out of the way to get to the banks that they thought were going to go under, and often did go under, in these terrifying bank runs, they were called. After Roosevelt gives that first fireside chat, they line up to patriotically redeposit their money. Now, that's leadership. How did he do that? In that first fireside chat, I tell the story of how he, when he was preparing it, he looks out and he sees them taking down the scaffolding from his inauguration, and he sees a workman. He says, "I'm going to write something that workman can understand about banking," and that's what he did. And then he delivered it in a totally new way. He did for speaking what Bing Crosby did for singing, which is to have a new relationship with the microphone. You know, many people still don't understand the microphone. You know, John Kerry sometimes talks as if he doesn't realize the microphone has been invented. You know, and he's not the only one. And at that time, and for thousands of years, for all of human history, leaders had talked to their people as crowds. They had exhorted, they had orated. And with the microphone, suddenly they could talk to their people as individuals. And so I saw all these letters in the Roosevelt Library. I felt like you were sitting in my living room when I heard you speaking on the radio the other night. He had a conversational tone. For the first time, it's a transformative, revolutionary idea. They thought it was magic almost, that they had this different relationship with a leader who they were never going to know, but they felt as if they knew him. And that's the secret to success in today's media culture. What do they pay Katie Couric the big bucks for? Because she speaks conversationally. People feel like they know her. And this is what Roosevelt essentially invented. That's my argument anyway. And used it to save the country during its greatest crisis since the Civil War. Now, in the process of doing that, he also almost improvisationally rewrote the American social contract. And that's where you and the Commonwealth Club come in, because this process of changing the society that we live in and the entire relationship between the government and the people, the new deal, which dates from the 1932 convention, it was a bargain, a deal, a social new deal. All that it means is it's a new social contract. They actually, I tell the story, a speechwriter ripped it off from a cover story in the New Republic. So it wasn't like it was Roosevelt's idea or even a speechwriter's idea, but they then adapted it and changed that deal, that bargain. And that process arguably began right here in September of 1932, a couple of months before Roosevelt was elected president, when he made a West Coast swing and came to San Francisco. He was advised not to come to California by his own people because they patronized him and thought he was too weak physically to make the trip. And they tried to argue that he shouldn't come out here because Charles Evans Hughes had lost a very narrow campaign against Woodrow Wilson in 1916 by getting involved in California politics, and it backfired on him. He lost. Wilson won. You don't want to do that. Get involved with Hiram Johnson, who was an important senator you had. Don't do that. But he knew that they just didn't want him to come because of his polio. I deal a lot with how he handled his polio and how it changed him, changed the country. And he finally said, I'm going. And they said, his advisor said, why? He said, because I want to. And he took this very vigorous trip to the West Coast. And one night in the Palace Hotel, he started to outline for Raymond Moley what would become the inaugural address, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, inaugural address, which several months later, but he was very long-headed is a good way to describe him. He didn't make plans, but he had a general sense of direction. He had a general idea of what he wanted to say in his inaugural address and started outlining it that night in San Francisco, late at night. He liked to work late at night, and then he'd often sleep in and have his advisors come into his bedroom in the morning. Did that a lot when he was president, smoking about 20 camels a day in that cigarette holder because he had bad gums. But then he comes and he gives this speech at the Commonwealth Club. And Bill Clinton has referred to this as a very important speech and important for what he was trying to do. Al Gore came here on the 70th anniversary of that speech, and he understood its importance. And I wanted to dig a little. It has sort of taken on the status of myth within certain people in the Democratic Party. I wanted to dig a little deeper into that speech that he gave here in San Francisco, and I thought I would. I'm not going to bore you by reading a bunch of excerpts from the book, but I thought I would read you what I wrote about the Commonwealth Club speech, just a page and a half or so. Roosevelt was scored points with offhand remarks calling Herbert Hoover, whom he never mentioned by name, Humpty Dumpty, or mocking his lateness in responding to the Depression. When Republicans echoed Lincoln's 1864 slogan, "Don't change horses in the middle of a stream," Democrats chanted, "Change horses or drown." When Democrats spread the rumor that Hoover had exploited Chinese coolies while a mining engineer in Asia 30 years before, Republicans retaliated by whispering that FDR's polio was actually venereal disease that spread to the brain, a lie they would resurrect in the years ahead when battles over the New Deal turned bitter. For the most part, FDR kept his speeches unspecific. One exception was a speech to the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco during his Western swing in late summer. Written by Adolf Burley, the substantive address had the ironic distinction of being the campaign speech that the candidate himself had the least involvement in preparing. By one account, he barely even saw it until he reached the lectern. Because FDR had no time to sand down the edges and apply his usual caution, it reflected the thinking behind the early New Deal more explicitly than anything else he said in the whole period. The Commonwealth Club speech managed to combine all that was wrong and right about FDR's worldview. The first theme, disturbing in its implication, was that, quote, our industrial plant is built, overbuilt. Our last frontier has long since been reached, unquote. With growth and exploitation of natural resources as a dead end, Roosevelt said, the goal should be, quote, administering, unquote, existing economic arrangements, not, quote, producing more goods. Even if FDR was by nature much more optimistic than Burley's text conveyed, this popular but false premise embedded in the mindset of New Dealers would have serious consequences until World War II. Until World War II, the Roosevelt administration offered no growth agenda beside public works. I told you that mine was a warts and all book about FDR. Policies were implemented without regard for their impact on productivity. Expanding the pie was not much a part of the discussion. This was perhaps the central conceptual flaw of the New Deal. It's a big flaw. I mean, we didn't get out of the Depression until World War II. The second, much more inspiring part of the Commonwealth Club speech was its emphasis on an updated social contract whereby, quote, every man has a right to life, and this means that he also has a right to make a comfortable living. He may, by sloth or crime, decline to exercise that right, but it may not be denied him, unquote. This was a revolutionary concept, which FDR expanded on in the years ahead, culminating in his landmark Second Bill of Rights speech in 1944. Americans are still debating whether health care is a right and other ramifications of the deep philosophical shifts that FDR launched at the Commonwealth Club almost inadvertently in 1932. So I go on and say some other things. He went after reckless business leaders. The campaign was coming to a close. A few weeks later, it's election night. Eleanor sat crying quietly in a corner, according to her cousin, Corinne Alsup. Quote, now I will have no identity. I'll only be the wife of the president, she said. Later, Eleanor herself wrote, the turmoil in my heart and my mind was rather great that night. By contrast, Sarah, FDR's mother, told her son elatedly, this is the greatest moment of my life. Late on election night, FDR let his hair down a bit as his son James helped him into bed. You know, Jimmy, all my life I have been afraid of only one thing, fire, FDR mused. Tonight I think I'm afraid of something else. Afraid of what? James asked. I'm just afraid that I may not have the strength to do the job. Then Franklin Roosevelt said he was going to pray to God for strength and guidance and asked his son to do the same. Pray for me, Jimmy. So the 32 campaign, which I cover in this book, helped to set up this defining moment when our whole definition of what government owes us and we owe government changed. You know, there's a lot of talk now about Katrina. Did President Bush respond fast enough to Hurricane Katrina? And the question is not asked, should President Bush have responded to Hurricane Katrina? Everybody assumes, without debate, that the president should respond when people are drowning. Or they're on rooftops crying for help, that this is all of our responsibility, that on some level we're all in this together. That began at what I call the defining moment. Before that time, If you were drowning, it wasn't any of the government's business, or so they thought. It was every man or woman for himself or herself. There was a senator from Virginia who almost became Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, at the last minute he was excluded, named Carter Glass. And Roosevelt went touring with him in Virginia and said, there are people starving here. You know, this is why I'm doing all these New Deal programs. And Glass said, well, that's not our responsibility in Washington. It's unfortunate that they're starving. Maybe voluntary efforts could help them from starving, but that's not government's role. So something very big started to change at the Commonwealth Club. And it wasn't a plan. Roosevelt didn't have it all worked out in his head. His aide, Raymond Moley, said to claim that the New Deal was carefully planned is like saying that a little boy who has broken baseball bats and dirty clothes and old pennants in his room, that it was all put there by an interior decorator. It was very improvisational, instinctive. Eleanor had a lot to do with it, because she would travel as his eyes and ears, and she would tell him what was working or not working in the New Deal. So if something wasn't working, he wanted to know. He wanted to make mid-course corrections. To me, this is relevant to what's going on now, to have a president who really wants to hear the bad news, not only and puts performance ahead of loyalty instead of loyalty ahead of performance. It's a pretty basic management idea and extremely important in the success of the New Deal. And then, even though it didn't happen in the first 100 days, I do tell the story of Social Security, which was in 1935 and was his greatest domestic achievement and the ultimate embodiment of this new social contract. But while not getting bogged down in the alphabet soup of agencies, because Roosevelt himself didn't care that much about them. He just wanted something to work. He believed in what he called, in a speech written by a reporter, now later for Newsweek, nowadays I get fired for this, but a reporter wrote a speech for him that said he believed in bold, persistent experimentation. Take one idea. If it doesn't work, admit it failure candidly and try something else. But above all, try something. Work the problem. That's what the American people expect. That's, I believe, why President Bush is so low in the polls right now. People don't feel like he's getting up every day and working for the American people, working the problem. He started last night. The point of that speech was to say, hey, I'm doing something. That's what the whole thing was about. Why else create a sense of crisis? It was his first primetime speech about domestic issue in more than 5 years. Because he wants to show, even he gets the point, that presidents do have to show they're doing something. Well, Roosevelt was the one who really established that. And just to give you a sense of the contrast, he comes to office, and in his first week, he not only has that first fireside chat, ends prohibition, rescues the banks. This is all in 8 days. They say he saved capitalism in 8 days. Holds the first modern press conference. He was to hold two a week, 998 press conferences. And it was so unusual after a time when questions were submitted in writing before Roosevelt that the reporters actually clapped at the end of the press conference. And then he said, I think it's time for some liquid refreshment. So they speeded the end of prohibition. The most important thing, that he did was the Civilian Conservation Corps. Now, anybody here who likes enjoying the outdoors, if you go out in this area and you walk on trails, you hike, you bike, you ski, a paralyzed man was indirectly responsible for the American ski industry. The first ski trails were carved by the Civilian Conservation Corps. They planted 3 billion trees. And he said in his first week, I want 250,000 young people out working in the forests by summer, 4 months. We'll pay them $1 a day, labor movement didn't like it. All his advisors said, it's impossible. You can't get that done. And he made it happen. He knew enough about government from his experience during World War I at the Navy Department, and he knew enough about human nature and how to motivate people that even though everybody told him it wouldn't happen, he made it happen. He made the impossible happen. He did the same thing during World War II. He said, I want 50,000 combat aircraft by next spring. They said, no can do. Made it happen. So my argument, and I've been criticized a little bit for this, is that if he was president after September 11th, it wouldn't be 4 years and counting before the computers at the FBI were fixed or before our ports were reasonably secured. It would be 4 months. Give him a little bit of time. But he'd make it happen. And that's leadership. So this book is really about leadership. I do have a lot of personal stuff in it about Eleanor, and she almost ran off with her bodyguard and blew up Franklin's career, and then she had this actually very important relationship with Loretta Hickok, very important, because Loretta, you heard the part I read about how Eleanor was depressed about the idea of becoming First Lady. Loretta, with whom she exchanged very passionate letters, convinced her that she could hold press conferences, the first ever held by a First Lady, that she could write a newspaper column, that she could travel around the country and report back to Franklin almost as a reporter, which is what Loretta Hickok was, and be an extremely important accountability device for FDR. And so this relationship, Eleanor blossomed right in this period of the first 100 days as well, went down into coal mines, did all sorts of things, flew with Amelia Earhart, and became the Eleanor Roosevelt that we knew and a full partner with her husband in changing the country. So I do have, you know, a lot of personal things in here, a lot about polio and how he changed from being a snob and a lightweight. They actually used exactly the same words about him that they used about Bush, lightweight. F.D. Roosevelt, Feather Duster Roosevelt, that's what he was called. How he changed from that into the Franklin Roosevelt that we know. That's kind of the beginning part of the book. And then I get to the main narrative, which is how he saved our system in 1933. Then, of course, he did it again during World War II, but that's been much more covered by other authors over the years. And I thought that this period hadn't had a book of its own and hadn't been covered in this kind of detail. So that's why I undertook this project. I wanted to thank my old friends for coming today. My brother Harrison Alter and his daughter are here, and all of you for showing up. And I'm happy to take any of your questions. The harder, the better. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to you, Jonathan Alter, and we've got lots of questions from this audience. I've been going back and forth trying to decide which of the first two are the most important to ask about FDR. I think this one wins. To what degree was FDR an intellectual, and to what degree should a successful president be one?
He was not an intellectual by any means. When John Maynard Keynes, who loved what he was doing, the famous British economist, came and met with him in the mid-30s, and he left, and he said, he's an economic illiterate. Herbert Hoover had about 50 IQ points on FDR. Herbert Hoover was a brilliant man. But FDR was a political genius, and I argue that to be a great president, you do have to be a brilliant politician. And he also was tremendously intellectually curious. So he was constantly, and I think there's also a big contrast there to the incumbent. I haven't made any secret of feeling that way. They described his brain trust, as it was called, because he was happy to hire very, very smart people. But they described their meetings with him as an intellectual ransacking. He wanted to know. And then on some things, he was very, very knowledgeable. I mean, you could draw a line across the United States, and he could tell you every county that it went through. And during World War II, his grasp of geography, you remember that he loved collecting stamps, was such that he often knew more about the terrain than a lot of the generals. And he did know a lot about history. But it wouldn't be right to call him an intellectual. However, he had a very supple intellect, and that's extremely important. And I think a lot of his suppleness and his flexibility, which was criticized as unprincipled early in his career, that really served him well in responding to problems. And I do think that's also a contrast with the status quo, where you have a kind of a rigidness. I think they both grow out of crises that they had at age 40. You know, Roosevelt never walked after he got polio. And Bush had this crisis with drinking, or his wife said, you know, it's me or Jack Daniels, et cetera. And Bush became quite self-disciplined, maybe the most self-disciplined president we've had, but it hardened. And Roosevelt, and I explain what happened to him at Warm Springs and how it changed him, he became more supple intellectually and in his response to people. And that worked spectacularly well for him. Now, I've forgotten, what was the second question?
I think you did it. Here's the second question, yeah. the one we didn't get to. The first part of the second question is, are you sufficiently recovered from your 3:30 a.m. call to the Donahue?
Good question. Yeah, I did call Imus at 3:30 because he helped me a couple weeks ago when I did my first interview on the book. It was on Imus in the morning, and he helped get it on the New York Times extended bestseller list. So now he's working on getting it on the real bestseller list. I got a very nice review in the New York Times, but it helps more to be on Imus and similar shows.
Which leads to a whole raft of questions here about the media today and the media in FDR's time. Let me see if I can summarize them so you can address it as one big question. Obviously, the reach of the news media in Roosevelt's time was much more limited than ours. It was also much less fragmented than ours. Could Roosevelt be successful in today's kind of media environment? How would you get a message across if you had one to give? And could he have withstood the kind of picking and scrutiny, deep scrutiny, that goes on today?
Well, first of all, I think that it's impossible to answer that question definitively, but we did have a different media setup in those days, but remember, there were thousands of local and locally owned newspapers. That's pretty fragmented. And many of them had Washington correspondents. And, there were seven or eight newspapers, I'm sure, in San Francisco at that time, at least three big ones. The reason he held two press conferences a week was he held one for the morning papers and one for the afternoon papers. So it's true, they didn't have bloggers, but they did have afternoon newspapers in those days. While the reporters liked him, the publishers came to loathe him. I tell a story of William Randolph Hearst. Roosevelt was actually nominated by your senator, William Gibbs McAdoo. Hearst claimed credit, and Joe Kennedy did too, for nominating Roosevelt, but it was really McAdoo. But Hearst, at the beginning, liked Roosevelt. He made a movie about a good dictator starring Angelica Houston's grandfather, Walter Houston, to try to instruct him on how to be a dictator. And Roosevelt actually worked on the screenplay a little bit. But then he turned viciously against him, like a lot of the other press lords. So the idea that he had an entirely compliant press and wouldn't today isn't really right, because he was attacked viciously on policy grounds. But as, you know, Stalin, Delano Roosevelt, the raw deal, sometimes even, I hate to say it, sometimes they would call it the Jew deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was really venomous stuff going on in the 30s. So in a lot of ways worse than what we see today. But it's true that they didn't report on the fact that he used a wheelchair every day. And nowadays they would. Everybody knew he had polio, but the kind of game that he played, which I deal with a lot, is to manage it so that people thought he was lame but could walk. And he had this fake walk he perfected with a where he'd sort of swivel his hips with one hand on his son and another on a cane and create the appearance of walking. And the newsreel photographers were not allowed to shoot that. They knew implicitly that if they did, that they wouldn't be going to these twice-a-week press conferences for very much longer. But they were getting something pretty substantial in exchange that you don't get now, which is interact with the president. So I think nowadays what would Roosevelt do? He'd go on Oprah, and he'd talk about how, you know, polio had changed him, and we have a whole different view of it now. And I think he would figure out how to make it work for him. But he was such a master communicator that I think he would be thriving in today's environment as well.
Let me remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Jonathan Alter, editorial writer for Newsweek magazine and author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And people keep wanting history to repeat itself. One of our questioners says, in your book, you describe an anybody but Roosevelt movement at the 1932 Democratic Convention, which FDR overcame with guile. Do you foresee Senator Clinton similarly overcoming such a movement in 2008?
That's a great question.
Isn't that good?
Because in some ways, they're in similar positions. Roosevelt had a lot of momentum in 1930 and 31 going into the convention after he'd been overwhelmingly reelected governor of New York, in the same way Hillary Clinton will be overwhelmingly reelected this fall. But then a lot of opposition developed, and the trick was overcoming that opposition and creating this aura of inevitability. I'm not sure that it'll work quite as well for Hillary because while there had been a prior Roosevelt as president, it was nearly 30 years since Theodore Roosevelt had left office. So there wasn't Roosevelt fatigue at that time. And I do think that what Hillary is up against is, do people really want to go Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton? Or are they ready... You know, are they ready for something new? And so she's got a whole set of other problems. She's not she's a talented politician, but she's not. I don't think she is as talented as FDR or as skillful a communicator. So I'm in the minority among the punditry, and I'd be really interested in your view, Susan, since you covered presidential politics for so long. But I don't think she's going to make it, personally. I could be proven wrong, but I don't think she will be the Democratic nominee. So
won't be able to overcome it. One more from contemporary, and then we'll switch back to the book. But our audience here is much interested in your thoughts on Tony Snow and whether the replacement of a press secretary can mean a new day for Bush.
Does anybody here know the name of FDR's press secretary? Stephen Early. He was a descendant of Jubal Early, the Confederate leader. The reason I ask that question is, and I wrote an article about this last week on Newsweek.com, I don't think it matters who the press secretary is. You know, the American people don't care who has that job. And he can have a couple of week honeymoon and, you know, maybe people will write stories about how he's more accessible than Scott McClellan. But it's up to the president. And if Bush really wants to, as Lincoln said, think and act anew, or as Roosevelt said when he flew to the convention and accepted his nomination in person for the first time in American history, it's hard for us to imagine. But before that, nominees didn't give acceptance speeches at the convention. They didn't show up at the convention. You know, a lot's changed in politics. But he said, I want to get rid of what he called foolish traditions. So I think President Bush really wanted to change his relationship with the press, he would hold maybe not two a week, but maybe one press conference a week and have a rotating pool come in, and then people would see that he's not dumb, as some people think he is, and that, you know, he's working the problem and he's thinking about immigration or whatever the other issues are. I don't know whether it would work for him, but I think it's his best bet. I mean, you know, the first rule of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. And he's at 29%. this is not good. He's getting down to Nixon territory. So he's got to do something, and hiring Tony Snow ain't it.
I want to ask you about the inauguration timetable. You make a brief note in the book that people always assume, because it was such an extended and unhappy and tense period between Roosevelt and Hoover during that transition, that the inauguration date got moved, when in fact the effort to do it had been going on for a decade. Do you think the country is better served, and a new president is better served, by having a longer period of time from November to March to actually pick a cabinet, think about a program, or do you think the world moves too fast?
I think it moves much too fast, and I think it was good. It, as you said, the inauguration was moved into January, mostly at the instigation of Senator George Norris, because he didn't like what the lame duck Congress was doing. They were creating all sorts of mischief. So they moved both of them back by constitutional amendment. I actually think maybe you could move it back further. I think we should move more toward a parliamentary system, not completely, but in parliamentary systems, when the government changes, there can't be more than a few days before you have a new government. So I think the party in that's out of power should prepare a little better for the transition and before the election. They have actually, one of my college roommates was in charge of doing that for John Kerry this last time. Didn't get to implement his plan, but they at least had thought about it. And I think November to January is plenty of time.
A couple of questions about the war here from the audience, and I know that your book is about the earlier part of FDR's term. But do you believe, in studying him, do you believe that he knew about the attacks on Pearl Harbor well before they happened? And what do you think about President Bush knowing about 9/11 or the extent of 9/11?
I think both of them are in the category of ridiculous, just to be really blunt about it. I've been unsparing in my criticism of Bush, and I think that Roosevelt could also be a very devious man and a manipulative man. I enjoy sort of telling the stories of his various acts of deviousness and manipulation, but I don't think that the people who adhere to that theory have really, first of all, I don't believe the world generally works in terms of conspiracy theories. I believe in more of the screw-up factor of history that when the more you report on these guys, the more clownish and incompetent they look, the closer you get. And their ability to kind of keep these huge secrets is minimal. But also, if you just think it through, why would FDR want to fight both Germany and Japan at the same time when the United States wasn't ready? We had to wait for months to build up our military forces before we could even effectively enter World War II. At that time he was more eager to get into the European war, which he had been trying brilliantly to prepare the United States for since the late 30s, and a very isolationist nation. And I don't think he really was spoiling for a fight with Japan at that point, and was not happy to see most of the American fleet destroyed at Pearl Harbor, though a couple of carriers were out to sea. People use that as evidence. Well, the carriers were gone, but actually a remarkable number of the ships, battleships, were parked in Pearl Harbor and were destroyed. As for Bush, I that just seems cloud cuckoo land to me. Why would he want to see, whatever one thinks of him, why would he want to see a lot of people, including a lot of people he knew, killed? It just doesn't make any sense. Okay. So.
All right. One more reminder for our listening audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Jonathan Alter, editorial writer for Newsweek magazine and author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. I wonder, again, to follow up a bit on the war issue, can you talk about a phrase you use in the book of FDR being an almost appeaser. You say in the early years, sort of a decision, at least a public decision, to deal only with domestic policy and to do everything he could to illustrate to the public that his concerns were only domestic. Was that appeasement in the sense we come to think
well,
of?
Well, I don't think it was an appeasement in the Chamberlain sense.
Yeah.
And remember, he worked very closely with Churchill. He felt in 1933 that he had a policy of what he said in his inaugural, first things first, and he wanted to worry about domestic recovery. Hoover had believed that the sources of the Depression were international, and that, you know, somehow if you bolstered the gold standard and did all these other things with international finance, that we would come out of the Depression. And Roosevelt believed that was wrong, and he actually blew up this world conference that they had in London that was a huge deal at the time in June of 1933. And John Maynard Keynes said Roosevelt had been magnificently right in blowing up this conference, but the consequences were that we sort of pulled out of international relations for a few years. It was probably a good thing that we did, because everybody was an appeaser at that point, because nobody wanted war. They'd just been through this awful World War I not too long before. And so if he had been involved in international, and he did give some speeches on it, he wasn't a total isolationist, but and he also he understood very early that Hitler was a menace, long before most other leaders. But if he had gotten involved in a lot of negotiations with Hitler in the early 30s, it probably would have taken the form of some kind of appeasement. So it's better that he just kind of withdrew and was more nationalistic early on. But you have to realize how strong the economic orthodoxy was, particularly in the Republican Party, but also in much of the Democratic Party. It's hard to believe, but the orthodoxy was balanced budgets, gold standard, even if it meant raising taxes sharply in the middle of the Depression, which is not a good idea. So the people now who think that cutting taxes is the magic medicine for everything, their, you know, grandparents, in some cases literally, wanted to raise taxes in the middle of the Depression, because that's how the Republican Party was very fiscally responsible. It didn't happen to be the right thing at that time, but this idea of tax cutting was not popular. And the gold standard was like a religion. So when Roosevelt moved off the gold standard in the first 100 days, and I'm very careful not to get bogged down in gold because it gets boring real fast, but there were actually his budget director and James Warburg, a big advisor, they actually walked the streets of Washington till dawn and said, this is the end of Western civilization. This is the end of Western. That's how much people believed in the gold standard. And that's how big a break this was. But remember, it wasn't radicalism, because he was reforming, not overthrowing the status quo. They came to him, just to give you a quick example, in his first week, New Dealers, Democrats, came to him and said, you've got to nationalize the banks. You know, take them over. And then the fallback position from the Brain Trust was postal banks. Can you imagine if the patronage-ridden post office ran the banking industry of the United States? Would we have had the kind of prosperity that we have now? No. You know? I mean, these were big decisions. And he said, I'm going with the conservative, you know, bank rescue plan, which had actually been designed by Hoover's people. Hoover had totally failed, and they were yelling at each other at 1 o'clock in the morning on the night before the inauguration. It was really high drama in this transition that I try to convey. But in terms of the bank rescue plan itself, go with the more conservative one, which is what they did. And then they also cut the budget a lot initially. And Roosevelt cut his own pay, cut the pay of Congress. He thought that people had to sacrifice in a time of crisis. Did he raise taxes later? Absolutely. And President Bush is the first president in American history, any war, doesn't matter what the war is, Spanish-American War, Vietnam War, every other president has raised taxes to pay for the war. Because there are only two choices. You can either raise taxes when you have a war, or you can put it on the credit card for our children to pay. Those are the only options. And the idea of cutting taxes during a war would have been utterly unthinkable for Franklin Roosevelt. Sorry to go off on that tangent, but
it's funny how it all seems so connected to exactly where we are today. We've got a question here about immigration. What would FDR say about the current debate we're having on immigration?
You know, he had a kind of a balanced approach. He was when World War II started, he did secure the borders because he was worried about spies coming over the borders. But he also, in the middle of the war, when there were labor shortages, because we went from having this horrendous unemployment to when the war started, there were actually labor shortages, he started the Bracero program, which was the first guest worker program. So I think he would have had a fairly balanced approach and not anything hugely radical. And he liked to calm fears rather than arouse fears. And I guess the line that I use is that he said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I tell the story of where that line came from. They thought it was from a department store ad for girdles or something. Mm. And I searched through all of these department store ads and I couldn't find the ad. And then I found out that it was actually a Republican head of the Chamber of Commerce who was Herbert Hoover's very close friend who had used the line in the New York Times in 1931. And I don't know whether Roosevelt took it from that, but that was the only prior reference on the Internet, which I thought was kind of interesting. But I think Bush often, his motto is, the only thing we have to use is fear itself.
All right, I think we've got time for one more. This could be the subject of your whole next book, Jonathan, but I think it's a good sum of what we've talked about today. What would you say the future of the new social contract is today, the one that FDR set in motion? Is it universal health care? Are there more social programs? Or is it, in fact, a reversal of the very contract that FDR put in place?
It's very much on the table, but there was good news for people who believe in the FDR social contract last year because the American people soundly rejected privatization of Social Security, which was a repudiation of the original idea behind Social Security, which was that you should not be subjected to the whims of the market, that it was guaranteed return. And so they rejected that. So somewhere in the DNA of the American people now is this understanding of Roosevelt's idea of the social contract. And so I don't think where they're eroding this contract is that the government is performing so badly in things like Katrina that it's hurting faith that government can be there to do anything good or constructive. And that's very harmful to this more expansive view of a social contract. Roosevelt, by the way, didn't care very much about the means. You know, he wouldn't say, well, it has to be, you know, this health care plan or that health care plan. He just wanted to sort of move forward. And I do think that it is that universal health care is the big issue on the table, and that whoever gets it done will also reap the benefits of it. It's a very complex problem. I wish Roosevelt had done it when maybe he had the chance, and I talk about why it didn't happen at the time Social Security went through. Mostly not because he didn't want to do it and believe in it, but because he didn't think it was politically possible at that time. But I do think it's politically more than possible now, and that it's about who can understand the complex policy implications of it. It's a very complex problem with a lot of moving parts, and also muster the political will to get it done. And if the Democrats have half a brain, which they might not, they will put that front and center both in the midterm elections and in the 2008 presidential campaign.
Yeah. Well, thank you. With that.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Our thanks to Jonathan Alter, editorial writer for Newsweek magazine and author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Susan Raske, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.